Hello and welcome to CIFAR Sounding. I'm your host, Simba Wiltz.
And I'm Asla Gonser.
CIFAR Sounding is a production of Central Florida Animal Reserve,
where we engage the world of the big cats through our mottos of compassion, conservation, and commitment.
At CIFAR, when it comes to big cats, it's about vision.
You can find out more about us on our website at cflar.org.
We're also on social media. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cflar and on Twitter at cflarbigcats.
We also have a YouTube channel at youtube.com/CFL Animal Reserve.
This week, we were really excited to get our first look at the new facility from the air. We recently published a video that was provided to us by RKC Site Solutions of drone flyover of our facility in construction.
And so what did they capture in the video?
Well, it's really fascinating once you see the project from the air. The scope of the project is huge, and it also gives us a good chance to see the real progress that we've made. At the time when this video was taken, it was taken just before Thanksgiving. We had just gotten all the poles in the ground. There were several new pole barns that had roof structures that were put on them, and we had all the plumbing run as well. So you can actually see all of that from the aerial angle. And because of the height that these drones can get to, you can literally see from one corner of the facility to the other corner of the facility, all from an aerial view. And then they also did some really cool swooping fly-throughs of the facility.
And all those are available on our website for people to see?
Yes, available right now. Make sure you go to the YouTube channel and you can see this amazing footage of a new big cat facility in progress.
And where are we next for the facility as far as progress goes?
Well, as the video said, we are trying to raise the remaining funds that we need to finish the project. Unfortunately, a number of construction delays as well as some unanticipated weather has pushed us a little bit beyond our existing plans. So in order for us to finish, we still need to raise about $250,000 so that we can complete this project.
And at the moment, we're currently part of a holiday challenge with the CrowdRise event, trying to raise some money through there, correct?
We are, and this is a great time because with all these challenges that are taking place, we're actually able to make our donations go further and use a platform that gives everyone a chance to see where we are stacking up against other charities that are competing. After the first week, we are in a very solid fourth place, and in fourth place, you actually do still win prizes, so we're in position to get an extra $10,000 if we can hold our position throughout the rest of the contest. But I would note that we are less than $10,000 away from being able to take third place, and third place would net us an extra $25,000, which would be really, really helpful at this point.
So how many charities are part of this holiday challenge?
When I counted at the beginning, right before it started, there were over 1,000 charities were in this challenge, and CIFAR right now is ranked number 4, so that's an incredible showing that we've already had.
Absolutely, that's wonderful.
Now, we just need to pull it all the way off here so that we can get to the end as high as we possibly can, because right now it's all about how much extra money that we can make out of this challenge. At the top, there is a $100,000 prize, and I know it would be a wonderful thing if we could snag that.
And the next challenge for this coming week is to get as many new members as we can.
Starting this Tuesday at noon, the challenge is the number of donations that can actually be raised. So it is purely about the number of donors. It doesn't matter how much, doesn't matter if it's a $10 donation or if it's a $100 donation, which we would certainly like, but just having the number, the raw number of donors is what is going to push us over the top in order to get ready for the next challenge. And the one who gets the most donors in the span of that week will get an additional $10,000.
So we definitely want to try for that one. Get everybody you know just to donate, even if it's $5, $10, anything. It will help us out greatly.
And it will be a fantastic addition so that we can continue work on this very, very, very extensive project.
And that challenge is from Tuesday till the following Tuesday, correct?
That's right. Thank you.
great. So everybody get out there and get that working. That way we can make sure the next flyover has a lot more to show for it.
And since we had this flyover, I know that there are probably some people who are looking at it and trying to see exactly what it is that we're trying to accomplish with this. Thought it might be an interesting discussion to talk a little bit about the enclosures and what it takes to actually build these enclosures.
Yes, because obviously it's not easy to build a habitat that can house a large animal like a big cat, and in some cases, multiple big cats in one enclosure.
One of the more interesting facets of this is the wide variability in terms of what people have done, as well as what is actually required. The distance between what people have done and what is actually required is pretty significant.
Well, I actually did a little bit of research on the web just to see if I were to put in, I want to build a big cat sanctuary, you know, what comes up, or a big cat enclosure. And there's a lot of information on the web, but just as you mentioned, some of it is based on legal notices as to what you have to do to follow the rule of law on whatever state you're in. But some of it is people saying that, you know, you really need to do more than that, that those minimums aren't enough in order to provide a good sanctuary for these big animals that's more humane.
In some states, there are actual licensures for sanctuary versus for exhibitors versus for even private use in some cases. But the state of Florida has decided to create one overarching law that's going to cover all of captive wildlife. So it doesn't matter whether or not someone is a wholesaler, a breeder, a distributor, or an exhibitor, or a sanctuary for that matter. They all must fall under these minimum requirements, which are located in the Florida statutes.
And how good are those minimums? Are they really a good set of minimums to work with, or do you really need to go above and beyond that to create a good habitat?
I think it's only fair to mention that the minimums are just that, the minimums. There is a minimum standard under which you would want to, say, raise a child as well. But if you can exceed that, then certainly you'll be giving that child a better life. And that still applies with captive wildlife as well. The standards are somewhat changing over time, especially since there is always the challenge of trying to make sure that the industry will persist and it's not impacted by regulation. Yet at the same time, they want to make sure that the standards are going to cover the needs of most of the creatures that we're serving.
Well, I like the analogy that you brought up before about raising a child, because of course, in the case of a sanctuary and these big cats, you are raising children, but they're just not human children, they're cat children. But it is a good point that, you know, sometimes you have enclosures that don't quite have as much frills as the next one, but is it really enough for the cat? Maybe it is. But we've actually had a show that we specifically discussed that there is also a top limit of what you can do for an enclosure, at which point there is not much more benefit for the animal.
If you look at some of those sources, like the ones that you found on the web and whatnot, you probably found a lot of differences in people's opinions on what was actually needed.
Yes, I did. In fact, well, for example, one of the minimum standards was that the square foot area of the enclosure for one cat be 300 square feet. And if you have two cats, that it's 450 square feet, that was a minimum in California. But the site I was looking at basically said that really isn't a good standard for long-term care. Maybe that's good for a temporary enclosure. There are different sites that have different opinions on what makes for a good and humane enclosure for big cats.
All of them get back to the reality that each cat, each enclosure, each situation is fundamentally unique. And so there is always a certain amount of performance standard when it comes to building enclosures for big cats.
And what do you mean by performance standards?
Well, a performance standard basically is how well whatever it is that you've done actually performs. So the test for whether or not an enclosure perhaps, say, meets the requirement that an animal could not escape would be that the animal doesn't escape.
Right, but that's not the best way to do it. I mean, you do have to have some standards to begin the process of building something that would be expected to hold in a big cat.
That's true. And fortunately, we do have those standards, and the state of Florida actually lists them out for all of the different species that are considered captive wildlife. To give you the briefest overview, captive wildlife, at least in the state of Florida, is broken down into a number of classes where you have everything from class 1, 2, 3, and then those animals that are not classed. Class 1 is where you're going to have your most quote-unquote dangerous animals, where your simians are, your old world monkeys, new world monkeys, elephants, of course, the big cats, and several poisonous reptiles that are in there as well. If anybody wants to actually see a standard themselves, then they can certainly go online. The Florida statutes are online so that you can look at them specifically. However, when it comes to the wild felines, it is then again broken down by individual cat. For example, if you were to look at tigers, for one or two animals, a cage 24 feet by 10 feet, 8 feet high, is required for one or two animals. But for each additional animal, you have to increase the cage size by 25% of the original floor area.
And that, of course, is a minimum standard.
Correct. So that's 240 square feet is the minimum standard for one or two animals.
With an 8-foot high fence, you would also have to have a roof, correct?
Yes. In the case that you've got that particular configuration, the 24 by 10 by 8, that does require a roof. You can have enclosures that are uncovered, but they have to be over 1,000 square feet and have jump walls that are at least 10 feet high with a 2-foot, 45-degree inward overhang.
Overhang, oh, I see what you're saying, angled in. Do you have like fencing on that, on those angled in poles, or how does that work?
Exactly. So you would have some kind of fencing such that they could jump perhaps that 10 feet to get to the top, but the overhang would prevent them from getting a paw hold to clamber over the top. Now, if someone decides that they don't want to put that kind of jump wall up, then they have to have it at least 12 feet high.
And that's enough to keep a cat in. I think back to some of our fun facts and how high some of these guys can jump.
It also depends heavily on the cat. So, for example, when it comes to jaguars and leopards, they can't be kept in uncovered enclosures except in facilities that have wet or dry moats. And all of that has to be approved in writing by the Fish and Wildlife Commission. So for those cats that are well-known escape artists, they are already by law set that they can't have that kind of enclosure.
It has to be a roof enclosure.
A roof or some kind of dry or wet moat.
Interesting.
Dry moat might be something that has a deep pit that's a separation where it goes down and out at the same time. So if you think about how a place like Animal Kingdom is, Animal Kingdom has pioneered some of these wonderful vistas where they've been able to give people fantastic views of their animals. But if you were to look at their enclosures from a sideways stance, what you would see is that from where the people sit, they have an uninterrupted view, sort of like an endless pool, where they would see, and it would look like the end of the enclosure just kind of flows directly into the other side of the enclosure. But there could be an 8-foot gap and a 10-foot pit between them. But if appropriately set, then people would not see that.
Right, so the vista looks like just a plane that you're looking out over and seeing the animals, but there truly is this chasm between you and them.
Exactly. And a wet moat works for those cats that really don't want to swim, but it also works really well for cats that once they're in the water, they don't really have the ability to leap as much because the water is obviously going to weigh them down a little bit. And the depth of the water means they've got to jump through all that water and then make vertical leaps.
And what about the idea of the fact that if you have fencing around an enclosure for a specific cat or couple of cats, what about fencing around the perimeter itself? Is that also a requirement?
Oh, good question. And indeed, perimeter fencing is required. The entire facility is required to be perimeter fenced, and they are very specific in the statutes that it's not just about the animals, it's also about the public, making sure that the animals are safe from the public as much as the public is safe from the animals. Generally speaking, they will say that it's 11 gauge and 8 feet tall. And it would be preferable, of course, to have barbed wire along the top, but it's not an actual requirement.
So you've got this fencing that's on the perimeter of the facility or around a certain set of enclosures or something that's a perimeter. And then you've got fencing that's the actual enclosures themselves. So what kind of structures are we talking about for these?
You can't see it in our current flyover because the fencing has not been put up. But what we are doing is actually a combination of some of the best practices that are out there. All of our enclosures are actually going to be roofed enclosures, high roofed enclosures, so the cats will still be able to get sunlight and sunlight will still be able to get in from the sides. But the roofs on the enclosures will enable us to not have to worry about having different types of cats in some of those enclosures. Now, a number of our enclosures, in fact, most of our enclosures are over 1,000 square feet at this new facility. So they don't technically have to have roofs, but because of the way that we're doing the construction, it will enable us to have the best of both worlds.
And what kind of roof are you talking about? Like actual covers so that they're protected from rain and all that kind of thing?
Yes, it actually starts with a pole barn. And these pole barns we have modified, and you can see this in the video as well. We have modified the pole barn from having something standard like a 4x4 that would hold it up to an 8x8, which is actually four times the size. And these are robust, thick poles that will withstand a cat bouncing up against them. They are concreted into the ground, not just pushed into the ground, but concreted into the ground 6 foot deep. And that way they are going to be able to have a wind load that will withstand a hurricane force winds up to 140 miles an hour. So the combination of being able to withstand a hurricane as well as withstand the strength of the cats is obviously a big goal of ours.
And then you put what kind of fencing between those poles to be the sides or the walls?
Inside, we're going to run chain link fence, and it's going to depend on what kind of cat that we're dealing with. We may have some chain link that will be 9 gauge. We may have some chain link that might be 6 gauge or even stronger in some instances. For those listeners that are trying to figure out kind of what this gauge means, the gauge actually gets thicker with the smaller number. So if you have something that is 11 gauge, that is thinner than something that is 9 gauge. And for comparison, most of your fencing that you would see, say like at a construction site, is 11 gauge. So 9 gauge is going to be much thicker and 6 gauge is going to be even thicker than that.
So how tall are these enclosures so that they can get some sun from the sides?
Well, that's a good point. The requirement is to be 8 feet. However, we are going to be going up to 12 feet at the base. So the roof is going to start at 12 feet and then go at a steep angle up to the point of the roof where the spine is. And so overall, each enclosure is probably going to be about 16 feet in the air.
So there'll be plenty of room for the big cats, too. And once you do have basically the spine like that of the roof, and you've got the poles and you've got the fencing, how about the shift enclosures? Because obviously you still need a place to move the cats out when you want to go in and do something to clean up their enclosures, for example.
The shift enclosure will allow the cats to have individual shifts, which is a big thing that we've always wanted for them. And they will be able to go into their individual shifts and either eat or rest and have plenty of room to move around since each individual shift is probably going to be about 10 feet.
Do you leave these shift enclosures open so that the cats have more room to roam around when you don't need to isolate them?
Not generally. Their main enclosure has plenty of space with that over 1,000 square feet to move around. We prefer to keep the shift enclosures usually for training, treats, or feeding.
So it's also part of their conditioning to have that be a separate place.
Right. Shift enclosures, coincidentally, are a requirement. At one point, it certainly wasn't a requirement, but now it is a requirement that enclosures be built in a manner that can allow for a keeper to interact with the cat without having to actually be in the enclosure.
And you can also use these shift enclosures for isolation in illness cases, things like that?
No, not for illness. The shift enclosure is not built for long-term stay. So if a cat is truly ill and needs to be isolated medically, then we would have to move them to a separate enclosure that conceivably could be a medical enclosure of some sort, but they would still be too close to their enclosure mates if left in just the shift enclosure for them to actually be able to convalesce.
And how about surgeries and such? I know that in the past that's been an issue as to where to do surgeries and try to make that work.
We've not had an issue with where to do surgeries. We have two surgical suites at our current facility, one in the front and one in the back that does have pavers that are on the ground that allow us to clean off the floor very well. And we can set that up as an outdoor surgical suite, perform any surgeries that are necessary, and then the cat can actually recover inside that enclosure. It's highly likely that we will use a structure or a plan that is similar to that at the new facility until we can get a full-on veterinary facility.
Also have an idea of what an enclosure should look like so that it looks nice for the cats. You don't want to see an animal that's in just a concrete cage with walls and wires. So what do you think about that?
We would certainly agree. The concrete cage, concrete box, that is literally two human generations old thinking. Since then, we have seen incredible enclosures. We've seen interior designers get involved. We've seen architects and artisans and agriculture. And in some ways, that is what has kind of created the problem of perception when it comes to big cats in captivity.
Which perception are you talking about? Just the fact that they're unhappy? Is that what you mean?
Well, not so much the fact that they're unhappy. It is really an expectation that people have when they are going to go and see a tiger. For the grand majority of the population, seeing a big cat involved one of two scenarios, either going to a circus or going to a TV show and seeing them perhaps on TV. Now, those two situations are extraordinarily limiting. That means that the cats have either been seen in an entertainment fashion, in which case there's so much spectacle and ooh and ah around them that it's not realistic. And then the other is perhaps them in their natural habitats, which are, of course, the ultimate enclosures, if you think about it, because every one of those natural habitats has got some kind of fence around it or some kind of border for which the cats should not cross. So what we're really looking at is how do you go somewhere in between? Now, the modern zoo these days, an AZA accredited facility, is going to spend anywhere from $1 to $3 million on each individual enclosure. That's a pretty remarkable number. And $1 to $3 million in an enclosure is going to have some amenities that are clearly there for the cats, but a good majority of them that are clearly there for the people. In our role as a sanctuary and making sure that the cats have their needs met, $1 million enclosure is not necessary. They can have a fantastic life in an enclosure that costs a fraction of that and that will still be fully featured. They can still have their water features so they can splash and play. They can still have fresh water to drink. They can still have high perches that allow them to get off the ground simultaneously if necessary. And, of course, they can still have their toys, which they enjoy using quite a bit.
And we've talked about in previous shows about enrichment and how important that is for the cats to actually have a happy life is to bring in enriching toys and, in some cases, different smells, different kinds of activities to give them something interesting to do.
Right.
But let's talk about the interior, since you kind of mentioned that. Interior decorating. So what's on the inside of these enclosures? We've kind of talked about the external, how to keep them in. What about the things inside that make it, you know, comfortable and homey for them?
Well, there's, again, requirements, and then there are preferences. And when it comes to the requirements, some of these are painfully obvious. The cats need to have access to fresh water, fresh, clean water at all times. And usually two sources of water is the best mechanism that we've found, where they may have a tub, but then they'll also have a drinking bucket of some sort so that they can't submerge themselves in the tub and somehow get it foul such that they can't subsequently drink it.
Okay.
If you think
you don't want to drink the bathwater.
That's pretty much it. Although we have seen quite a few cats that will just lay in the tub and, you know, they'll drink the water as they're laying there. Kind of a, you know, a drink and a soak at the same time.
Calgon, take me away.
Exactly. And so that other water bucket that they can't sleep in and they can't get in enables them to have clean water, and it's a lot easier to fill.
Okay, so how are we doing that at the enclosures for CIFAR?
Currently, we've been using these large stock tanks, these metal stock tanks that are usually 8 feet wide and probably about 2.5-3 feet deep. And these stock tanks sit up where the cats can jump into them and they can lay down and have a good little soak. What we're looking at now, and we have already done the cutting for this, you'll probably be able to actually see it in the video, are concrete culverts that are also 8 feet wide. Actually, some of them may be a little bit larger, but they will be able to be laid flat on the ground. And once the ground is dug out, have a pool bottom of sorts put in so that we can have permanent drainage and the cats can have a pool.
And you'll have a way to refill and empty the water from it easily.
Right. And that will be of great benefit for humans as well, because one of the biggest challenges is dealing with the drain sometimes in our current tubs. With regards to the water buckets, we have traditionally used these heavy gauge stainless steel buckets that have been used for water for the cats. Now, I chuckle a little bit at that because you'd think that that would be tremendously strong, but we have had cats that have peeled them like bananas because of just pure strength. So going to a straight up concrete bucket that will also be able to be drained and filled with relative ease is going to be extremely important for us because especially for those cats, all our cats are older now, but especially when they're young, some of the cats find tremendous fascination with the noise and the bubbles and everything that's made when you're filling the bucket with a hose. So they pull at it, they play with it, they attack it, they use that as an opportunity to see how much trouble they can get themselves into.
And cause trouble for you trying to fill the bucket.
Exactly. So trying to make water a little bit less dramatic is going to be a goal. Now, not too much less dramatic, because obviously that's still enrichment when they get to stick their face in bubbling water as it's being filled. In fact, I haven't met a cat yet that doesn't love to get a good fresh drink when the bucket's being filled and they can kind of get that aerated water.
Talked about the tubs and the water tubs and water buckets. What about the sleeping areas?
Yes. Another requirement that is definitely an important one in the statutes is that the cats need to be able to have an elevated platform that they can get off of the ground, and that can be in any number of forms how that platform is done, but it's an elevated platform so that all of the enclosure residents can be off the ground simultaneously. That can come in so many different forms. It's scary. I've seen everything from just a wooden beam that's basically put into the air so that, say, a leopard can lounge over it, to full-on mini houses that are built for cats to lounge in, complete with their own heating and cooling systems and air conditioning and everything. So it really can be remarkable.
So what are the plans for the new facility as far as this goes?
Well, some of that is going to depend on construction still. We have plans to use some culverts. We also have been looking into some large plastic structures, the kinds that you might see that go under the road, for example. Those actually make for fantastic cat dens because they're nice, round, and tend to be cool, even in spite of the heat of the summer.
So they can get inside them but also crawl on top of them.
Exactly. And we would just stabilize them either using dirt or some kind of other stabilizing material to make sure that they don't roll around all over the place. They would very easily be able to lay up on top of them and lounge out.
And you'd have one of these for every cat that's in that particular enclosure?
At least.
Okay. What about the cats that like to jump around? And I know cougars and such, or leopards, whatever, they do tend to like to jump around and be in the trees and stuff. Do you have extra scaffolding for them?
That's a good point. And indeed, we do have plans for platforms, and this is a fantastic opportunity for some of our community partners to get involved. We did have a Girl Scout that came and built platforms for our cougars so that they could use steps to get up on top of their dens in there. And building platforms is a simple shop project, which would be suitable for any high school or scout group, or even just a casual hobbyist who wants to see something that they made go to good use.
Even one person that would like to help us out. Sounds like a plan for that too. And are you also building in some kind of path or trail or something for visitors to be able to see the cats?
Well, there are a number of paths that are going to be going through the facility. In fact, you can see a couple of those from the air. The most important one is not the actual people path. The most important path in the facility is actually the feed trail. If you can imagine, of all the areas that are going to be used on a pretty much a daily basis, the feed trail is going to be the one that's the most important, because we're going to have to transport all of the food from our food prep areas up front to the cats in their enclosures, and we will be using that quite frequently, as you might imagine.
But there will be some kind of trail also for the public to see when they do tours and such.
That is also true. That trail is going to be facing a direction that will allow people to see the full scale of the enclosure, which is kind of exciting, because an enclosure is going to have one side that's got to have a security, and it's got to have the animal shifts, and that can get very busy from a visual standpoint. So being able to have people walk up on a clean side where it's just a big, long expanse of enclosure so they can get a good look at the cats moving around is going to be very exciting.
So getting back to impressions, I know that there's a lake on the property, and this is really going to be a really nice place for the big cats and for the people to come and see, correct?
That's what we're going for. And we would invite everyone to go online, take a look at the flyover video to show what progress we've made thus far. Still have quite a bit of work to be completed, but even the pictures that you're seeing there taken before Thanksgiving are already starting to be outdated as construction continues. So it's a great time to be involved. It's a great time to make your donations go for something that you'll be able to tangibly see come out of the ground. And hopefully, once we get open early part of next year, actually come see in person.
CFAR Sounding is a production of Central Florida Animal Reserve,
where we engage the world of big cats through our mottos of compassion, conservation, and commitment.
At CFAR, when it comes to big cats, it's about vision.
Send us your thoughts. You can get us on email via contact@cflar.org.
Tune in again next week for more discussion. My name is Asla Gonser.
And I'm Simba Wiltz. Thanks for listening to CFAR Sounding. Thank you.